So I'll give Ramsay his standard introduction, because if this was my introduction, I'd use it every time anyway. The Oxford Companion...
You could have it.
Well, one day.
Yeah.
The Oxford Companion of English Literature called Ramsay Campbell Britain's most respected living horror writer. The internationally renowned weird fiction scholar S.T. Joshi has written that future generations will regard him as the leading horror writer of our generation, every bit the equal of Lovecraft or Blackwood. You know, so I couldn't write a better introduction than that. Ramsay, on the welcome page of your website, it says, "I am Ramsay Campbell, I write horror."
Yeah.
Do you think there's still stigma attached to the term horror in terms of literature?
Yeah, there's always going to be a thing, but I think happens, you tend to get these face-offs between the kind of graphic horror, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know, Clive Barker is a genius of that kind, and the, you know, the subtle variety, or, well, if I say the literary variety, that's fine, because Clive clearly writes literary prose, you know, so that... It tends to get a bad name every so often because of, you know, the media will latch onto it. It was, you know, the video nasties in the 80s, the horror comics in the 50s. But it's interesting, isn't it? Now all the video nasties you can buy in HMV in a lovely Blu-ray, and seven of them now rated 15.
Yeah,
to,
yeah.
For anybody over 14 to watch, whether it was being seized by the police 30 years ago. So I think it just does happen that every so often opprobrium will attach itself to the field, and it's equally, you know, science fiction gets a bad rap, and you can see. I think, if anything, I probably see more ludicrous comments made by the general media about science fiction than about horror fiction these days. Maybe that's because we're not so noticed for the moment, but we'll be back out there again being hunted down by the media, I have no doubt, but we can take it, we always have.
Yeah,
we've survived.
I mean, because myself, primarily I write comics, and I always, when people, I tell people I'm a writer, which people always think is a lie in the first place, and then when they press you to say what you write and you have to say comics,
yes.
You know, that carries the same kind of, not stigma, but it's a brilliant catch-all term, as horror is for what you do, but you kind of have to stop yourself then unpacking it and sort of saying, but not what you imagine it to be. I mean, a completely different set of things.
That's right. I mean, to be honest, I used to say, I'm a writer, and then they would say, oh, what are you? And I say, well, I write horror. You would see that there was a different reaction immediately.
Yeah.
Not always, but sometimes. So these days, I'm a horror writer, and, you know, so let's put that up front right now and see how you react to that. And to be fairly honest, a fair number of people don't actually back away or go in the next room very quickly and lock the door. So there's hope yet.
So when do you think that you first became aware of horror as a genre, or that something you were interested in?
Lord, when I was extraordinarily young, I mean, I think probably when I started reading Dorothy L. Sayers' anthologies, great short stories of detection, mystery and horror, which were published by Gollancz in the 20s, have been reprinted very frequently since then. Those old yellow-covered Gollancz books, there's some of them out there in the bookcase, actually, not those books, but Gollancz. And now this is kind of interesting, because those were the first that I came upon, and it seems to me that she was possibly the very first writer, the very first anthologist, editor, to put the term horror on an anthology, but in a way trying to reclaim it for literature. Because alongside here, there were the Not at Night books that were being published in the 20s, which, not all of which were bad. I mean, they had H.P. Lovecraft, and for heaven's sake, you know, they had some very good stories in the old Weird Tales pulp magazine, but there was a lot of second-hand, rather, you know, crass and crude stuff. M.R. James loathed them, he specifically inveighed against them. And I think Sayers was genuinely trying to say, well, yes, but this is horror too.
Yeah.
You know, Arthur Machen, Alvin Blackwood, E.F. Benson, and the rest of them. And this constantly happens, and it's happened ever since, that you will get people trying to reclaim the field for its place in literature.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, the precise time I was really aware of this, 11 years old, I'd saved up my pocket money, half a crown a week, to buy what I think was probably the first hardcover book I ever owned, which was Best Horror Stories, edited by John Keir Cross, for Faber. And this was, when I think about it, you know, this was a couple of years after the horror comic panic, which, as I said, was like the video nasties panic 30 years later. And clearly he too was trying to reclaim the field. So, you know, this, and so he had, and what was interesting to me, I mean, it's 15 bob, 6 weeks, I must have done some extra odd jobs and stuff. I think I saved up 6 weeks, but I got it anyway. I would have bought it for the cover alone, which is a great painting by Felix Kelly, a gay New Zealand surrealist, one of whose paintings is in the Lady Lever. And it, the book had people you'd expect, so it had, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, Ambrose Bierce, but it also had Ray Bradbury, and it had William Faulkner, it had Graham Greene. But above all, as far as I was concerned when I was 11 years old, it had a 40-page novella by Herman Melville, he of Moby Dick, called Bartleby, or Bartleby the Scrivener, some of you may know, I don't know. It's a psychological study of a sort of a hollow and empty man, basically. It's Clark working in a 19th century Wall Street office, basically, who just has no personality, and ultimately dies of not existing. And there's 40 pages of it in Melville's best style. And here am I, 11 years old. I basically paid half a crown for this story, you know. But the point was, and in fact, Kierkegaard in his introduction says, many people may not think this is a horror story, but I do, which is why I've included it. Thing was, I did. I actually, that was probably, you know, a crucial point for me. I thought I'm not wasting my money, and that it somehow fitted into what now became part of my definition of what horror fiction was. So I suppose that's a long answer to a very short question. Which is what you'll get all the time.
I'm counting on it.
All right.
And your first proper encounter with Lovecraft took place just along the road from here, near the Mystery, didn't it?
In quantity. Yeah. I've read some of Lovecraft in anthologies out of the library, yes, but I read The Colour Out of Space when I was 8 years old, and that got me very viscerally. I mean, I found it very, very disturbing, that story, more than anything else I've read in the field up to that point. But you couldn't find Lovecraft in any quantity. You find the occasional story in an anthology. Now, there's a place called Bascom's in Smithdown Road. It's now an electrical show, or electrical wholesalers, actually. It's the first shop on that block just by the Mystery, coming in this direction. And he used to have, well, it was one of those strange shops that no longer exists, really. You know, he had sweets on the one hand, and, you know, and I mean, I don't know, tins of stuff probably, and obviously cigarettes. But there was half of the shop devoted to books, some of which were secondhand, some of which were not. It always had a window display. And I remember this, you know, kind of, I don't know, April afternoon, I would always walk down there on a Saturday and see if there was anything I'd spend the half a crown on. And in the window was a book by H.P. Lovecraft called Cry Horror. I actually remember thinking, have I got enough money, you know, panicking. But in those days, I believed there was only ever one copy of a book somehow. But that was my somehow strange sense of, if that book went away, I'd never find it again. You know, so I had to have it. I remember sort of kicking through me, you know, Thrumpenses and Hakeneys and so on, for, you know, I finally got half a crown together and bought it. I was so kind of knocked out by having it in the first place, I actually scribed off school the next day and just read it from cover to cover. And I was just overwhelmed with this vision that was like nothing else I'd come across in the field. And also, you know, the structure, I was only instinctively aware of things like structure and, you know, the modulation, the build-up of language. But it all got to me as a package, you know. And basically, I'd already been writing short stories, which were terrible, believe me. Even had to go a couple of novels, which I didn't finish, and the world may be grateful for that. But this really gave me a focus of what I wanted to do. I genuinely wanted to imitate Lovecraft. You know, I wanted to convince myself that basically I was doing what he did. So I actually started writing stories, not immediately, but certainly must have been that year, set in Massachusetts. You know, I think it would be further than Southport, and by gum, it was apparent. You know, I wrote half a dozen of these. I was in touch with another member of the British Science Fiction Association. We'd been put together by the librarian there because we both took out issues of Weird Tales, and pretty well nobody else did. Pat Kearney, who later became, among other things, a great expert on the Olympia Press in Paris, and so wrote and also the locked case of the British Museum. He wrote books about those. But even then, he was very much an anti-censorship guy. He was publishing a fanzine called Gowdy, and I mentioned in one of our letters, you know, my letters to him, I'd written these stories like in the Matter of Love Club, and he said, could he see them? Now, it's interesting because so little do I value them, that I actually did what Lovecraft used to do. I sent the only copy, which is handwritten. You know, if it had got lost in the post, well, that was the end of you know, didn't bother keeping the copy. And he liked them and said he wanted to publish one, but he also suggested I should get in touch with Lovecraft's publisher in America, August Derleth, at Arkham House. And, well, cut a very long story short, Derleth said, you know, typed them up because, you know, I don't want to read them in longhand, which I duly did. And this, and I was, well, let me see, I think I'm probably just about turned 15, or maybe not even that. I was 15, yeah. And he sent me a letter back saying, basically, these stories need a lot of work, but my God, was that ever true? I'll do you an example from them in a minute. You'll like this. But ultimately, he said, you know, if you do all this work, which not least, and this will, I'm sure you're going to be asking a question about this eventually, or this sort of thing, he said, basically, relocate them to England. Yeah, because, you know, obviously, you've obviously never been to America, and also, you know, if you invent a new place, a new milieu, you know, then it'll give them more individuality, which I duly did. I invented this area in the Severn Valley, I've never been there either. It was obviously not quite so apparent to Americans that I hadn't, so I got away with that. And weirdly enough, I remember this, you know, the stuff I'd written before Lovecraft, it wasn't very good. It was technically, you know, for a 12-year-old, technically all right. You know, they were actual stories with a narrative and a bit of a structure, in the beginning, middle, and end. There was a lot of dialogue in them, but once I read Lovecraft, I thought, you know, the way you obviously don't use dialogue, that's the way to do it, you don't use any dialogue.
Yeah.
And so I gave up using dialogue, but Dennis had to say, you know, put some dialogue back in, which of course I duly did. Mm. Do you want an example of what the first drafts he had to suffer? All right, I probably better stand back from the mic. I'll cover the microphone because this gets pretty fierce. I've read this thing so often that I think it's on YouTube by now as well. You can have it live. One of the things he said, you know, fix that telegram basically, or words to that effect. There's a scene in one of the earliest stories I did. Where somebody sends a telegram to a friend appealing for help. And I kind of think, do you know the telegram verbatim? And it's this. To Richard Dexter, come at once to Kingsport. Remember, this is a telegram. You were needed by me here as aid against agencies which may kill me or worse if you do not come immediately. We'll explain as soon as you get here. ... But what is this that flops unspeakably down the corridor toward this room? It cannot be that abomination that I saw beneath the accursed church in Asquith Place. Here, sharp Nicodem, soul of time. So I changed that. Anyway.
So yes, so you, Derleth asked you to kind of relocate this stuff to England, and so you came up with Brychester and...
Brychester. Yes.
Terrible thing where you've only invented things.
Well, don't you worry. Yeah.
And its surrounding districts. But a lot of people have said then post the publication of those stories, that there's kind of elements of Liverpool that creep in.
Sure.
And I suppose that, given the age you were and everything, that is completely natural. You're writing, you know, the landscape and the urban areas that you know.
Sure.
And I presume you can see that in that work, if you do read that work. But
yes, I mean, a little bit. I think it's still mostly just cobbled together, you know, bits of Liverpool, you know, in a sort of generalised way. But those very early stories, that first book, they're mostly they're just made up, you know. Yeah. I read up a bit about the Severn Valley and, you know, places like Gloucester and so on, you know, kind of stuck in bits that seemed to work. But it wasn't actually until I'd finished that book, I'd delivered it actually, and so I delivered it very, very early. Well, I just turned 17 when I delivered it, duly bought it and published it. And then I kind of pottered around doing various stories that really I wasn't quite sure what direction to take, really. So I did a variety of stories, none of which were very good. And then came, now almost immediately, though, also came one other great influence after Lovecraft, as well as Graham Greene, who I loved, you know, I started reading him. And because of Greene, in fact, it was as I read Nabokov, specifically Lolita, partly because it was a forbidden book, well, actually, you know, it was published, it wasn't that forbidden, but it had been controversial, but still is, obviously, partly because Graham Greene, you know, had a blurb on it recommending it, so I read it, and it was just a kind of another revelation, like Lovecraft, along quite different lines, about what you could do with language, you know, how you could write what's basically a comic novel on the most unlikely subject, how you could write also a very serious novel, which certainly has elements of comedy, but all the things you could do with language that I'd never realised, basically, you know, I wanted to do this stuff, basically. So I did some very terrible stories, you know, trying to learn from Nabokov. And then all of a sudden, I wrote, well, not all of a sudden, but, you know, without that much foresight, I wrote a story called The Cellars. And that was the very first story, which we have here, which was the very first story I'd ever set in Liverpool, you see. And while probably a few of the stories I'd been writing in the interim were sort of, you know, disguised Liverpool, this was the one in which I owned up to it. And the reason was, really, it was based very solidly indeed on a real location in Liverpool. Now, I don't know that the precise location exists any longer. It was off Rumford Place, which is off just around Old Hall Street way. And it was a series of quite extensive, I mean, at least the size of the floor plan of this building, I would think, series of cellars, basically. A friend of mine, John Rowles, as a bookseller, worked in Rumford Place, murdered later, sadly. He found them himself and thought I'd certainly like them, so he said, you know, take a flashlight down there and walk around, which I duly did. I'm absolutely knocked out by them. And, you know, how can I not write about them, basically? But I think that was the very first story I ever wrote that came out of a real occasion. And I think because of that, partly, I decided I was going to be specific about it. Actually, you know, although in the story it slightly veers away. It doesn't say Rumford Place. I mean, there's a walk in the story, which I'll do if you like.
Yes, if we could have a little bit of
Okay, which leads us to this. But I mean, this is almost historical fiction, by the way, because of course half this stuff has gone. I mean, our protagonist Vic. Which is a deliberately ironic sort of, you know, Victor is a deliberately ironic name because he's pretty feeble in many ways. Has taken this sort of quasi girlfriend Julie, who he works with, out at lunchtime to go and have a look at this. Which is exactly what happened to me. He was a sort of quasi girlfriend I worked with. So okay, here we go. And we're going down. Do you think we're starting there? Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll take slightly more. I'll start. Okay. All right. We're by St. Luke's Church. Okay. Having flaked all colour from the sky, the snow had stopped, but an insistent rain troubled the pigeons picking their way among the debris of St. Luke's Church. They started out. Vic jerked Julie's umbrella and bloomed above them, the same sunny orange as her coat. They crossed into Bell Street and passed the sonorous entrance of the Odd Spot Club. No longer, you see. Have you ever been there? Vic asked. I don't know anyone who'd take me, she replied. Vic was about to speak when a furtive-looking man with an armful of bottles pushed between them and was lost in the vestibule of 69A. Now, I would never go for an in-joke like that again. That really is self-indulgent. That was the location of the Liverpool Science Fiction Society. And that it now makes perfect sense, you see. But otherwise, most readers would not, well, no, quite understandably, wouldn't know what on earth that meant. The flowing arrow-headed ripples in the gutter accompanied them into Church Street, where commuters ventured from the cold, grey bulk of Central Station and ducked back. An icy wind started the rain towards them down the narrow two-way street. Julie plunged her hands into her damp pockets. The drenching gust raised goose pimples on the cars and hurled the pedestrians into shop doorways to choke on the stench of raincoats. Without warning, Julie darted across the road. Car wheels screeched in fury. Vic grimaced and waited for the army at the curb for the traffic lights to permit him to join battle with the mob across the street, each seeking gaps in the press to which he could slip. The drivers sat and cleaned their windscreens with their hands. when he meets Julie is enjoying the brief plush warmth of the tactless cinema entrance before the pallid splendour of the House of Bulle and the Cardona Coffee House. He urges her on. The rain still streamed down the toadstool boof or sooty buildings to the kaleidoscopic shops it served as their foundations, their windows full of lifeless shoes and dresses. Over all detached, the street lamps poured, and above the roofs, the live building clock stood with hands on hips. And, well, that sort of gives you a general sense of it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they go on across, well, actually, they cross exchange flags, and then we do kind of lose where we're precisely going. But yeah, I mean, most of that stuff no longer exists, doesn't it? I mean, you know, two-way street, Church Street, and so forth, not any longer, I'm afraid. But there you are. Now, strangely enough, I'm actually working on a trilogy right now, and it is basically set in the early to mid-50s, and a lot of that stuff now creeps back in again, because, you know, that's what was there then.
Okay.
And it's set entirely in Liverpool, in fact.
Okay.
So I've just sort of more or less completed the rewrite of the first novel.
Oh, fantastic. So, The Cellars, the theme of subterranean spaces, tunnels, catacombs, crypts, that's kind of a horror staple.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that you've returned to in a few of your own stories. Williamson's Tunnels feature heavily in Creatures of the Pool. How did you become aware of them? Did you already know? Well, I sort of found out about them quite late on. It's one of those things where you mention it to people and they just say, oh yeah, you know, and it seems like the most remarkable, bizarre thing that we should all be talking about. And yeah, everybody's like, oh yeah, the tunnels, you see them on the sign kind
well,
of thing.
Yes, that's right. I think it was someone at the university actually who mentioned them to me, and I didn't know about them until, probably the 80s. At the very earliest, I would think, that's right. But as you say, no, they're kind of taken for granted, often like the fish on the stone there. Not the fish, I think, well, the bird on the stone.
People who know about them just don't bother to mention them.
That's right, because they probably assume everybody else knows about them.
Yeah.
Right? And yet, of course, they are being extended, but they're being rediscovered.
Yeah, they're still being dug out now.
There's plenty to find.
Yeah, there's supposedly a house under there somewhere, isn't there, fully carved out?
Well, this is where he have banquets down there.
Yes, well,
let us hope to see them.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And Creatures of the Pool, strangely, is kind of how you and I first came into contact with each other. It was at the time you were writing it, because that was when I was writing my Haunted Liverpool book.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some adverts in various libraries and stuff, which were just saying if anybody wants to share any supernatural stories. And then one day I got an email from Ramsey Campbell saying that he'd like to share a supernatural story, which is not what you expect, really. So that's lovely. And very nicely, I am. My name is in this. Thanks, which is lovely. And Creatures of the Pool, so how heavily did you research it? Did you set about specific research for the book?
Yes, enormous amounts. And in fact, this is the thing. I mean, I knew I wanted to write my ultimate Liverpool book, you know. I'd certainly used Liverpool quite extensively by then, because that was written, you know, in this century, of course.
Yeah.
But I've been using Liverpool for decades, in fact. Again, mostly, in fact, almost entirely, you know, because of the particular location or something in Liverpool suggested a story, and therefore that's where I would set it. But I really wanted to do something that drew more on the history of the place, and particularly, you know, legends, if you like, and folk traditions, you know, urban folk traditions. And so what I tried to do was, basically I spent, whenever I went into I still do it, because, you know, I'm sure many of us here, you know, we're known to haunt second-hand bookshops, you know, which I've done for so long as I can remember. And I would always look in the Merseyside section, if it was, local history, whatever it might be. And the more obscure the book, the better. So I've got quite a nice bookshelf full of books published in the mid-19th century, a particularly nice one. That's reminiscing about the previous 50 years. So, that's got all sorts of stuff. I mean, actually, to be fair, the record office have reprinted some of them, but I don't think they've done them all. And so I would read through these when I could, once I've got them, and I'd make notes. I always carry notebooks, several actually. So I had a working notebook for what would ultimately become Creatures of the Pool. And sometimes I'd simply copy down what I'd found. Sometimes I'd kind of elaborate a little bit on what I found. Sometimes what I found would suggest something else that I'd put in as well. And then I wrote the book based on, you know, well, not merely based on all that research, but you know, once I'd found a theme, then I went for it finally. And as I say, it was kind of 15 years in the making, probably. But the thing is this, because I'd spent so long making notes, I can't tell you any longer which bits I've made up and which bits were research. Yeah, yeah. Not always, some of it, yeah. But some of it I genuinely could not tell you without going all the way back and looking it up if I could find it again. Whether you know that was a legend, whether it was a little bit of a tweak I made of something that I'd read, or whether it's completely new. I mean, for instance, the one about the theatre, which I believe now was in Paradise Street, the Church Street end of Paradise Street, was a theatre. It was built on a graveyard. In fact, initially, some of the graves were still there. When they did Hamlet, you know, they if they needed a skull, they would just go, you know, down the basement because you could just go through the wall and reach the skull and bring it up. Now, did I make that up or not? Well, no, I didn't. To be absolutely fair, no, I did not. I know I didn't, because that was in a book about Liverpool theatres published in about 1900.
Wow.
Unless, of course, the book itself made it up.
Well,
there's a double whammy there.
Exactly.
But I'm assuming I trust the book, then no, I didn't make that up.
So, Creatures of the Pool features lots and lots of Liverpool folklore, lots of Liverpool locations.
Sure.
And does touch upon where we are today and the sort of the central theme.
Yeah.
So if you could possibly do a little reading,
that
would be
I'll
amazing.
Yes, certainly do. The very spot on which we sit right now, I think, or pretty well. Let's see. Oh, very fine, very fine. Yeah, okay. All right. And this is told by, I should say perhaps it's Gavin, isn't it? Isn't really you, no, come on, he's not really you, but he's a tour guide who does, actually, this is kind of strange, because I was originally going to call it, because he does macabre and spectral tours of Liverpool, I was going to call it the Shiverpool Tour, but guess what? Lucy and John might not have been happy about that, but I didn't then realise that, of course, there is a Shiverpool Tour, so I had to call it something else, which is not nearly as good, but never mind. Anyway. As we enter Calderstone's Park, two adolescent girls in ankle-length white dresses meet us with a wreath each. My head prickles less from the flowers one girl's placed in imitation of an adornment than from insomnia. She and a friend produce more wreaths from the cardboard boxes on either side of the avenue to await the next newcomers. We're advancing between trees decorated with drops of this morning's rain when Lucinda blinks at my preoccupied frown, which feels weighted by the wreath. "I hope you'd sleep," she says. The avenue leads to a green shaded by trees, recalling the ancient woodland that once surrounded much of Liverpool. Among the trees, dozens of robed figures are celebrating Druid Day. In the distance, actors are performing a play designed to solitary goal for football practice. Children have tied ribbons to some of the trees around which they dance with their colourful tethers. A woman in a pointed hat, topped with streamers, is telling fortunes at a picnic table as she gazes into a bowl of water. A girl similarly garbed is leading people with forked sticks in their hands across the green, and I wonder if she has mistaken what the Druids were supposed to have meant by divination. I'm reminded of the stream used to start from the park and join the river miles away, close to James Maybrick's house. It's dry now, or has it gone underground? This has nothing to do with why I'm here. I need to find whoever spoke to my father. I can't see any park officials. Assigned directors of the Calderstones, which are housed in a roundish but angular building opposite the green. There are half a dozen brownish, irregular lumps of rock, some of them inside with obscure symbols. At least one of the rocks is almost my height. Though they're arranged in a circle, not everyone thinks they're druidic. Historians have concluded they belong to an ancient tomb, and the circle was constructed just a couple of hundred years ago during the Druid Revival. I peer through the reinforced glass of the locked door at the stones, one of which sports a mark like a large misshapen handprint. I wonder why my father would have cycled all the way here, 20 minutes' drive from the city centre. I'll leap forward a bit, I think, and do a little bit which has a rather mythic bit. They do consult one of the park people and discover that his father was not really examining the stones on the day when they were, you know, open to the public, but kind of feeling over them. Okay, here we go, and we go into the greenhouse. The long, narrow building is full of jungle, as if a strip of the landscape has reverted to one of its earliest states. And amid the mass of vegetation, leaves grow restless as condensation drips from the peaked glass roof. A path not much broader than our guide leads us down the centre of the greenhouse, and he halts on the far side of the bridge. "There you are," he says as I step on the bridge. "You're him. Stop there and spout," and then he went off. I do my best to control my anger in advance. Do you remember what he said? "It came this way." "What did?" Lucinda says. "You tell me. He was looking down there when he said it, that's all I know." I gaze into the water where he indicates and see ripples reshaping my reflection. "Didn't he say anything else?" "Said they must have too. Don't ask me what. We'd had enough. Didn't want him going on and on about stories we were supposed to know." "Which stories?" "Old ones about round here. Just tell you we don't know." "There are some." For a moment I think Lucinda is the speaker. The woman behind her is robed from head to foot in white, and her hair is much less devoid of colour. She's pressing her large hands against her thighs, as if to keep them in shape. "Will you tell us," says Lucinda. "What do you have in mind?" A ripple under the bridge reminds me where my father stood. "Any about water?" I say or ask. "I expect I like the one about the stag." "Then I expect we will," Lucinda says. "It's the earliest legend we have from when there was forest all the way down to the river. The story tells it was a stag the king's huntsmen could never catch. They'd see it through the trees and it would be gone as if it had sunk into the earth. In most versions it was by a stream, and in some a knight sees it turn to water." "It goes to the water, you mean," I say. "No," the woman says, and seems delighted to continue. "The stag turns into it. In the best version, the knight sees its horns are a fountain, and then the sunlight shines through it, and it's transformed into a wave that vanishes downstream. Sometimes he follows it to the river, or in some versions he waits by the stream in the hope of seeing it again, and eats only fruit that grows there, and drinks only from the stream. We take that to refer to fasting in order to achieve a vision, but it isn't clear when it dates from. Some commentators don't much earlier than King John, but there's nothing in Baxter to support that." "That's William Baxter. Once this is confirmed, Lucinda tells me, early 18th century, wrote the Glossarium Antiquitatum Britannicarum. He thought he'd discovered that the lost Roman town that's mentioned in Ptolemy was the earliest settlement around the pool." They refer to the lady. "They said not many of them, there may have been a pre-Roman settlement." "How's that supposed to fit in with your stag?" I ask. "But just as if we're talking about Mesolithic times, the settlers would have had to travel a long way. The argument is they would have had to be led. Something usually does that, don't they? I wouldn't call it new. In this case, it was more like something." "That'll be the stag again, will it?" "Something of water, maybe something older. There used to be a Christian tradition that the first settlers were brought to the pool by an angel or a saint. In some version it's St. Cuthbert. There was a Dockland church with windows that showed him leading his flock, and the last window had him descending into the river. It was all destroyed in the Blitz, sadly, but it sounds like a Christianized pagan tradition." "And do you know, I can't remember if I made that up or not." "I genuinely can't. St. Cuthbert's the church. I invented that all right, but no, who knows?" Thank you very much.
I think that we are actually running a little bit over now.
I'm begging your pardon.
It's not your fault at all, Ramsay. There's been a little bit of a knock on. Right. But obviously I should have left more time to talk to you.
No, don't worry.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for speaking to me and for coming today. And thanks to everybody for coming and for buying the tickets, and thanks to all of my speakers today who have been absolutely fantastic. It's been a brilliant day. I'm amazed that I've pulled it off.
Yeah.